Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Loris by Eugene Vodolazkin, translated by Lisa C. Hayden, narrated by James Anderson Foster. Prolegomenon. He had four names at various times. A person's life is heterogeneous, so this could be seen as an advantage. Life's parts sometimes have little in common, so little that it might appear various people lived them. When this happens, it is difficult not to feel surprised that all these people carry the same name. He also had two nicknames, one of them, Rukinets, referred to Rukino Quarter, where he came into the world. But this person was known to most people by the nickname Doctor, because he was, more than anything, a doctor to his contemporaries. He was, one should think, something more than a doctor, because what he achieved went beyond the limits of a doctor's possibilities. It is thought that the word vrach for medical doctor comes from the word vrati, which means to say an incantation. This similarity supposes that words as such, no matter what they meant, played an essential role in the medical treatment process. The role of words was more significant during the Middle Ages than it is now, because of the limited selection of medications. So speaking a lot was a necessity. Doctors spoke. They knew certain methods for treating ailments, but they did not pass up opportunities to address disease directly. Uttering rhythmic phrases that outwardly lacked meaning, they said an incantation over the illness, smoothly convincing it to abandon the patient's body. The line between doctor and medicine man was relative during this period. Patients spoke. In the absence of diagnostic technology, patients needed to describe in detail everything occurring within their ailing bodies. Sometimes they thought the illness left them, bit by bit, along with their unhurried, pain-steeped words. They could speak only with their doctors about all the details of their illnesses, and this made them feel better. The patient's relatives spoke. They clarified their loved one's statements or even amended them because not all illnesses permitted the sufferers to give reliable reports of what they had gone through. Relatives could openly express concerns that the illness was untreatable and complain, the Middle Ages was not a sentimental time, that it is difficult to deal with an ill person. This made them feel better, too. The defining trait of the person under discussion is that he spoke very little. He remembered the words of Arsenius the Great. I have often regretted the things I have said, but I have never regretted my silence. Most often, he looked wordlessly at the patient. He might say only, your body will still serve you, or your body has become unsuitable. Prepare to leave it. Know that this shell is imperfect. His renown was great. It spread throughout the entire inhabited world. He could not avoid notice anywhere. His appearances drew together many people. He would cast an attentive gaze upon those present, his wordlessness transferring itself to those who had gathered. The crowd froze in place, only small clouds of steam instead of words left hundreds of open mouths, and he would watch how they melted in the frosty air. And the crunch of January snow under his feet was audible, or the rustle of September foliage. Everyone awaited a miracle, and the sweat of expectation rolled down the faces of those in attendance. Salty drops fell, resonating on the earth. The crowd parted, letting him through to the person he had come to see. He would place his hand on the patient's forehead or touch wounds. Many believed that the touch of his hand could heal, and thus the nickname Rukinets, given to him because of his place of birth, but rooted in the word ruka, for hand, acquired additional meaning. His doctoring skills were honed over the years, reaching at the zenith of his life heights that seemed unattainable for a human being. It was said that he possessed the elixir of immortality. It is even said from time to time that this giving healer could not die as all other people do. The basis for this opinion is that his body had no traces of decay after death, maintaining its former appearance after lying under an open sky for many days. and then it disappeared, as if its possessor had grown tired of lying there. He stood up and left. Those who think this, however, forget that only two people have left the earth in flesh and blood since the creation of the world. Enoch was taken by the Lord at the revealment of the Antichrist, and Elijah was raised to the heavens in a chariot of fire. Holy tradition does not mention a Russian doctor. Judging from his infrequent statements, he did not intend to reside in a body forever, if only because he had worked with bodies his entire life. Most likely, he didn't have the elixir of immortality either. Somehow, things of this sort don't fit with what we know about him. In other words, one can say with certainty that he is not with us at present. It is worth adding, however, that he himself did not always understand what time ought to be considered the present. The Book of Cognition. 1. He came into the world in the Rukina quarter by the Kirillo-Belozersky Monastery. This occurred on May 8th of the 6,948th year since the creation of the world, the 1,440th since the birth of our Savior Jesus Christ, on the feast day of Arsenius the Great. 7 days later he was baptized with the name Arseni. To prepare the newborn for his first communion, his mother did not eat meat for those 7 days. In expectation of the cleansing of her flesh, she did not go to church until the 40th day after his birth. After her flesh had been cleansed, she went to an early service. She prostrated herself in the church vestibule and lay there for several hours requesting but one thing for her baby. Life. Arseni was her third child. Those born previously had not lived out their first year. Arseni survived. On May 8th of the year 1441, the family held a service of thanksgiving at the Kirillov Monastery. After respectfully kissing the relics of the venerable Kirill, Arseni and his parents set off for home, and Christopher, his grandfather, remained at the monastery. The seventh decade of his years would end the next day, and he had decided to ask Nicander, the elder, what to do next. "In principle," replied the elder, "I have nothing to tell you. Just this. Live, O friend, close to the cemetery. You are so gangly that it would be difficult to carry you there. And there's this, too. Live alone." That is what the elder monk Nicander said. 2. And so Christopher moved close to one of the nearby cemeteries. He found an empty log house some distance from Rukina Quarter, right next to the cemetery fence. The house's masters had not survived the last pestilence. These were years when there were more houses than people. Nobody could bring themselves to settle in this sturdy and spacious but airless house, particularly next to a cemetery filled with the plague dead. But Christopher brought himself to do so. It was said that even then he pictured the further fate of that place quite distinctly, that even at that remote time he allegedly knew that in 1495 a cemetery church would be constructed on the site of his log house. The church was built in gratitude for the favorable conclusion of the year 1492, the 7,000th year since the creation of the world. The anticipated end of the world did not come to pass that year, but Christopher's namesake did discover America, though nobody paid any attention to this at the time, unexpectedly for himself and others. The church is destroyed by the Poles in 1609. The cemetery falls into neglect, and a pine forest grows in its place. Apparitions chat up mushroom pickers from time to time. In 1817, the merchant Kozlov acquires the forest to produce lumber. 2 years later, a charity hospital is built on the cleared site. Exactly 100 years later, the district secret police move into the hospital building. In keeping with the property's initial purpose, that institution organizes mass burials there. In 1942, the German pilot Heinrich von Einsiedel wipes the building off the face of the earth with a well-aimed hit. In 1947, the plot of land is retooled as a military proving ground and transferred to the 7th Tank Brigade of the Order of the Red Banner, named for Kliment Voroshilov. The land has belonged to the White Knights Gardening Association since 1991. The group's members unearth large quantities of bones and missile shells along with potatoes, but they are in no rush to complain to the local authorities. They know nobody would grant them other land anyway. "It fell to us to live on land like this," they say. This detailed vision indicated to Christopher that the land would stay untouched in his lifetime, and his chosen home would remain intact for 54 years. Christopher understood that 54 years was considerable for a country with a turbulent history. It was a five-wall house. In addition to the four outer walls, its log framework had a fifth interior wall. Partitioning the framework formed two rooms, one warm with a stove, the other cold. When he took up residence in the house, Christopher checked for cracks between the logs and replaced the bull's bladder that was stretched over the windows. He took oily beans and juniper berries and mixed them with juniper chips and frankincense. He added oak leaves and leaves of rue, ground it finely, placed it upon coals, and worked to fill the house with smoke all day long. Christopher did not consider this precaution excessive, despite knowing the pestilence left houses on its own over time. He was afraid for the relatives who might visit him. He was also afraid for those he treated, because they were constantly in his house. Christopher was an herbalist, and all sorts of people came to see him. People came with torturous coughs. He gave them ground wheat with barley flour that he mixed with honey. Sometimes some boiled farro, too, because farro draws moisture from the lungs. Depending on the type of cough, he might give pea soup or water from boiled turnips. Christopher differentiated coughs by sound. If the cough was indistinct and didn't lend itself to definition, Christopher pressed his ear to the patient's chest and listened to his breathing for a long time. People came for wart removal. Christopher ordered them to apply ground onion with salt to the warts, or rub them with sparrow droppings mashed with saliva. He thought ground cornflower seeds, which were to be sprinkled on the warts, was the best method of treatment, though. The cornflower seeds drew the root from the warts, so they would never grow on that place again. Christopher also helped with bedroom matters. He immediately identified visitors with these concerns based on how they entered and hesitated at the door. Their tragic and guilty gaze amused Christopher, but he did not let that show. Without ceremony, he called upon them to remove their pants, and the guests silently complied. Sometimes he sent them to wash in the next room, recommending they pay particular attention to the foreskin. He was convinced the rules of personal hygiene should be upheld, even in the Middle Ages. He listened, irritated, to the unsteady flow of water from the dipper into the wooden tub. "What wilt thou say of this, then?" he wrote on a piece of birch bark in a fit of temper. "And how can it be that women let men like this near them? What a nightmare." If the secretive member had no obvious damage, Christopher inquired about the problem in detail. They knew he was discreet, so were not afraid to tell him. If there was no erection, Christopher suggested supplementing meals with expensive anise and almond or an inexpensive mint syrup. All increase the seed and promote bedroom thoughts. The same effect was attributed to the plant with the unusual name of livelong, as well as to simple wheat. Finally, there was also hare's ear, which had two roots, white and black. An erection would arise from using white, but vanish with black. The drawback to this method was that the white root had to be held in the mouth at the crucial moment. Not everyone was willing to do that. If all that did not increase the seed and promote bedroom thoughts, the herbalist moved from the plant world to the animal world. Those who had lost their potency were advised to eat cockerel kidneys or duck. In critical situations, Christopher gave orders to obtain fox balls, grind them in a mortar, and drink them with wine. For those not up to that task, he proposed eating ordinary hen's eggs while alternately taking bites of onion and turnip. Christopher did not exactly believe in herbs. More likely, he believed God's help would come through any herb for a specific matter, just as that help comes through people. Both are but instruments. He did not ponder why each of the herbs he knew was associated with strictly defined qualities. He considered that question frivolous. Christopher understood who had established that association, and that was all he needed to know. Christopher's help to his fellow man was not limited to medicine. He was convinced the mysterious effects of herbs spread through all aspects of human life. It was known to Christopher that the plant sow thistle, its roots as light as wax, brought success. He gave it to commercial traders so they would be received with honor and rise to great glory wherever they might go. "Only be not proud beyond means," Christopher warned them, "for pride is the root of all sin." He gave sow thistle only to those of whom he was absolutely certain. More than anything, Christopher loved a red plant known as the Tsar's Eyes, or round-leaved sundew, that was about the height of a needle. He always had it with him. He knew it was good to have some on his person when beginning any matter. Bring it to court, for example, so as not to be convicted, or sit at a banquet with it and fear not the heretic lying in wait for anyone who lets his guard down. Christopher did not like heretics. He recognized them using Adam's head, also known as mandrake. When gathering this plant near marshes, he blessed himself with the sign of the cross and the words, "Have mercy upon me, O God." After that, Christopher gave the plant to a priest for sanctification, asking that it be laid on the altar and kept there for 40 days. When he carried it after the 40 days had elapsed, he was able to guess unfailingly who was a heretic or a demon, even in a crowd. For jealous spouses, Christopher recommended duckweed, though not the duckweed that covers marshes, but the dark blue plant that spreads on land. It should be placed at the head of the bed by the wife. When she falls asleep, she will tell everything about herself on her own, the good and the bad. There was another method, too, for compelling her to start talking. Owl heart. It was supposed to be applied to a sleeping woman's heart. Few people took that step, though. It was frightening. Christopher himself had no need for these remedies because his wife had died 30 years before. They had been caught in a thunderstorm while gathering plants, and she was killed by lightning at the edge of the forest. Christopher had stood, unable to believe his wife was dead. She had just been alive. He shook her by the shoulders, and her wet hair streamed along his hands. He rubbed her cheeks. Her lips stirred silently under his fingers. Her wide open eyes looked at the tops of the pine trees. He urged his wife to stand and come back home. She was silent, and nothing could force her to speak. On the day he moved to his new place, Christopher took a medium-sized piece of birch bark and wrote, "After all, they are already adults. After all, their child is already 1 year old. I am of the opinion they will be better off without me." After thinking a bit, Christopher added, "Most important, this is what the elder advised." 3. They began taking Arsini to see Christopher after he turned 2. Sometimes they would leave with the child after a meal. More often, though, they would let Arsini stay for a few days. He liked being at his grandfather's. Those visits turned out to be Arsini's first memories. They were also destined to be the last thing he forgot. Arsini loved the smell in his grandfather's house. The smell was composed of the aromas of the multitude of herbs drying under the ceiling, and that smell did not exist anywhere else. Arsini also loved the peacock feathers a pilgrim had brought to Christopher. They were fanned out on the wall, and the design on the feathers was surprisingly similar to an eye. When the boy was at Christopher's, he felt he was somehow under observation. He also liked the icon of the martyr Saint Christopher, which hung under the Savior's image. It looked unusual amongst the stern Russian icons. Saint Christopher had the head of a dog. The child examined the icon for hours, and his grandfather's features, little by little, began showing through the touching figure of the cynocephalus. Shaggy brows, wrinkles extending from the nose, a beard that began at the eyes. His grandfather dissolved into nature even more readily because he spent most of his time in the forest. He began resembling dogs and bears, and plants and stumps. He spoke in a creaky, wooden voice. Sometimes Christopher took the icon from the wall and gave it to Arsini to kiss. The child thoughtfully kissed St. Christopher on his shaggy head and touched the dulled paints with the pads of his fingers. His grandfather observed the icon's mysterious current flow into Orsini's hands. One time, he made the following note. The child has a special awareness. His future presents itself to me as outstanding, but I have difficulty foreseeing it. Christopher began teaching the boy about herbal treatments at the age of 4. They wandered the forests from morning till night, gathering various plants. They searched for the pheasant's eye plant near ravines. Christopher showed Orsini its sharp little leaves. Pheasant's eye helped with hernia and fever. When this plant was given for fever, along with cloves, sweat would begin streaming off the patient. If the sweat was thick and gave off a strong and nasty odor, it was necessary, Christopher stopped short, looking at Orsini, to prepare for death. The boy's unchildish gaze made Christopher feel ill at ease. What is death? Asked Orsini. Death is when people are silent and do not move. Like this? Orsini sprawled on the moss and looked at Christopher, not blinking. As he lifted the boy, Christopher said inside, My wife, his grandmother, was lying exactly like that, and that is why I was very frightened just now. There is no reason to be afraid, shouted the boy, because I am alive again. On one of their walks, Orsini asked Christopher where his grandmother now dwelled. In heaven, answered Christopher. That same day, Orsini decided to fly to the heavens. The heavens had long appealed to him, and the attraction became irresistible after this announcement that his grandmother, whom he had never seen, dwelled there. Only the peacock feathers, from a bird most certainly of paradise, could help him with this. Upon returning home, Orsini got a rope from the entry room, took the peacock feathers from the wall, and used a ladder to climb onto the roof. He divided the feathers into two equal bunches and firmly tied them to his arms. Orsini was planning a short trip to the heavens this first time. He wanted only to inhale its azure air and, if things worked out, finally see his grandmother. He could also say hello to her from Christopher while he was at it. As Orsini imagined things, he could easily return in time for supper, which Christopher just happened to be preparing. Orsini went up to the roof ridge, flapped his wings, and took a step forward. His flight was rapid, but brief. Orsini felt sharp pain in his right foot, the first to touch the ground. He could not stand, and so lay silently, stretching his leg under his wings. Christopher noticed the broken peacock wings beating at the earth when he went outside to call the boy to supper. Christopher felt Orsini's foot and knew it was fractured. He applied a plaster with ground peas to the injured place so the bone would knit together quickly. He bound a small strip of wood to the leg so it could have some rest. He took Orsini to the monastery so his spirit would strengthen along with his flesh. I know you are planning to go to heaven, said Elder Nicander as soon as he saw Orsini. Forgive me, but I think your course of action is outlandish. When the time comes, I will tell you how it is done. They began gathering plants as soon as Orsini was able to put weight on the foot. At first, they walked only in the nearby forest. Then they would go further and further each day, testing Orsini's strength. Along the banks of rivers and streams, they gathered nymphaea, reddish-yellowish flowers with white leaves, to treat poisoning. Near those same rivers, they found the enchanted river plant. Christopher trained Orsini to recognize it by its yellow flower, round leaves, and white root. Horses and cows were treated with this herb. At the forest's edge, they gathered windflower, which grew only in spring. It should be pulled up on the 9th, 22nd, and 23rd of April. Windflower should be placed under the first log when building a log house. They also went looking for the mysterious sava. Christopher displayed caution here because encountering this plant carried the threat of muddling the mind. But Christopher crouched down in front of the child. If this plant is placed on a thief's tracks, the thieved item will return. He put the sava in his basket and covered it with burdock. Along the way home, they always gathered pods from the herb known as river crossing, which repelled snakes. Put a seed in your mouth and water will part, Christopher once said. It will part? Asked Orsini, serious. With prayer, it will part. Christopher began to feel awkward. Everything is about prayer, after all. Well, then why do you need that seed? The boy lifted his head and saw Christopher was smiling. That is the legend. It is up to me to tell you this. Once they saw a wolf while they were gathering plants. The wolf was standing a few steps from them, looking them in the eyes. His tongue dangled from his jaw and trembled from panting. The wolf was hot. We will not move, said Christopher, and he will leave. O great martyr Gheorghe, do help.
He will not leave, Arsini objected. He came so he could be with us.
The boy walked up to the wolf and took him by the scruff. The wolf sat. The end of his tail stuck out from under his hind paws. Christopher leaned against a pine tree and attentively watched Arsini. When they headed for home, the wolf set off after them, his tongue still hanging like a little red flag. The wolf stopped at the border of the village. After that, they often ran across the wolf in the forest. The wolf sat beside them when they ate lunch. Christopher tossed him pieces of bread, and the wolf would catch them in the air, his teeth clattering. He stretched out on the grass and pensively stared straight ahead. When the grandfather and grandson returned home, the wolf escorted them right to the house. Sometimes he spent the night in the yard, and the three of them would set out together in the morning to look for plants. When Arsini grew tired, Christopher would sit him in a canvas bag on his back. An instant later, he would feel Arsini's cheek on his neck and understand the boy was sleeping. Christopher stepped gently on the warm summer moss. With the hand not carrying his basket, he straightened the straps on his shoulders and shooed flies away from the sleeping boy. At home, Christopher pulled burrs from Arsini's long hair and sometimes washed his hair with lye. He made the solution from maple leaves and the white herb called enoch, which they gathered together in the low hills. The solution made Arsini's golden hair as soft as silk. It gleamed in the sun. Christopher wove leaves of garden angelica into his hair so people would love him. While he did so, he recognized that people loved Arsini anyway. An appearance from the child cheered people up. All the residents of Rukina Quarter felt it. When they took Arsini by the hand, they did not want to let it go. When they kissed his hair, they felt as if they had drunk from a deep, fresh spring. There was something in Arsini that eased lives that were anything but simple, and people were grateful to him. Before bed, Christopher told the child about Solomon and the centaur. They both knew this story by heart, but always appreciated it as if they were hearing it for the first time. When the centaur was brought to Solomon, he saw a person buying himself boots. The centaur began laughing when the person wanted to know if the boots would last for 7 years. As he walked further, the centaur saw a wedding and began weeping. Solomon asked the centaur why he was laughing. I saw on that person, said the centaur, that live he will not until the 7th day. And Solomon asked the centaur why he was weeping. How sad am I, said the centaur, that live this groom will not until the 30th day. The boy once said, I do not understand why the centaur laughed, because he knew the person would be resurrected? I do not know. I am not sure. Christopher himself also felt it would have been better if the centaur had not laughed. Christopher placed purple loosestrife under Arsini's pillow so he would fall asleep easily. Which is why Arsini fell asleep easily, and his dreams were placid. 4. At the start of the second septenary of years in Arsini's life, his father brought the boy to Christopher. Rukina Quarter is restless, said the father. People await the plague scourge. Let the boy stay here, far from everyone. You may stay too, Christopher offered, and your wife. I have, O father, grain to reap. Where will we find food in winter? Arsini's father just shrugged his shoulders. Christopher crushed some hot sulfur and gave it to him so they could drink it later at home with egg yolk, washed down with rosehip juice. He ordered them not to open the windows and to lay a fire with oak logs in the yard every morning and evening. When the coals begin smoldering, toss wormwood, juniper, and rue on them.
That is all. That is all that can be done. Christopher sighed. Guard thyself against this sorrow, O son. Arsini began crying as he watched his father walk to his cart. How short he was, walking with a springing gait. After half sitting on the side of the cart, he tosses his feet onto the hay, takes the reins, and makes a kissing sound to the horse. The horse snorts, jerks its head, and gently sets off. The hooves make a muffled sound on the tamped earth. His father rocks a bit, turns back, and waves. Diminishes in size and merges with the cart. Turns into a dot. Disappears. Why weepest thou? Christopher asked the boy. I perceive on him the sign of death, answered the boy. He cried for 7 days and 7 nights. Christopher was silent because he knew Arsini was right. He had also seen the sign and knew, too, that his herbs and words were powerless here. At noon on the 8th day, Christopher took the boy by the hand and they set off for Rukina Quarter. It was a clear day. They walked, not trampling any grass and not raising any dust, as if they were on tiptoes, as if entering a room where someone was deceased. On the approach to Rukina Quarter, Christopher took a root of garden angelica soaked in wine vinegar and broke it into 2 pieces. He took half for himself, giving half to Arsini. Here, hold this in your mouth. God's power is with us. The settlement greeted them with the howling of dogs and the lowing of cows. Christopher knew those sounds well. They could not be confused with anything. This was the music of the plague. Grandfather and grandson slowly walked along the street, but only dogs rushed to see them, pulling at their chains. There were no people. As they neared Arsini's house, Christopher said, "Walk no further. There is death in the air here." The boy nodded because he saw death's wings. They hovered over the house. They quivered over the ridge of the roof like warm air. Christopher crossed himself and entered the yard. Sheaves of unthreshed wheat lay near the fence. The door into the house was open, its gaping rectangle looking sinister under the August sun. Of all the colors that day, it had absorbed into itself only blackness. All possible blackness and cold. What could remain among the living after ending up in there? Christopher hesitated and took a step toward the door. Stop, a voice rang out from the darkness. This voice reminded him of his son's voice, but only reminded him, as if someone, not his son, was using that voice. Not trusting the voice, Christopher took another step toward the door. Stop, or I will kill you. A crash rang out in the darkness, and a hammer knocked against the door jamb as if it had tumbled out of someone's hand. Let me examine you, Christopher rasped. He felt a lump in his throat. We already died, the voice said, and we have nothing to do with the living. That Arsini may live. Do not enter. Christopher stopped. He felt a vein pulsating on his temple and understood his son spoke the truth. Something to drink, Arsini's mother moaned from the darkness. Mama, Arsini shouted and dashed into the house. He ladled water from a wooden bucket and gave it to his mother, who had fallen from a bench. He kissed her jelly-like face, but it was as if she were sleeping and could not open her eyes. His palms could feel the inflamed nodes in her armpits when he tried to pick her up off the floor. My son, I can no longer wake up. Arsini's father's hand seized him and flung him toward the threshold. It was Christopher who dragged Arsini away. Arsini shouted as he had never before shouted, but nobody in the quarter heard him. When silence came, he saw his father's dead body on the threshold. 5. Arsini moved in with Christopher after that. The boy is unquestionably gifted, Christopher once wrote. He grasps everything right away. I have taught him about herbal healing, and it will provide for him during his life. I will impart to him much other knowledge to broaden his horizons. May he learn how the world was created. One starry October night, Christopher took the boy to a meadow and showed him where the earthly firmament and the heavenly firmament meet. In the beginning, God created heaven and the earth. He created them in order that people not think heaven and earth were without beginning. Then God divided the light from the darkness and called the light day and the darkness night. Grass affectionately rubbed against their feet and meteorites flew above their heads. Arsini felt the warmth of Christopher's hand on the back of his head. And God created the sun to light the day and the moon and the stars to light the night. Are the orbs large? Asked the boy. Yes, well, you know. Christopher wrinkled his brow. The moon's circumference totals 120,000 stadia, and the circumference of the sun is, roughly, of course, 3 million stadia. They only seem small. Their real sizes are difficult to even imagine. Go upon the hill so high and gaze down on the field below. Do not the grazing flock seem as ants unto thine eyes? Thus are the orbs. They spoke for the next several days about orbs and omens. Christopher told the boy about the double sun he had seen more than once in his life. Its appearance to the east or to the west signifies great rain or wind. Sometimes the sun looks bloody to people, but this happens due to hazy vapors and indicates high humidity. Sometimes sunbeams look like hair, too. Christopher was stroking Arsini's hair. And it is as if the clouds are burning, but that indicates wind and cold, and if the rays bend toward the sun and the clouds blacken at sunset, that indicates foul weather. When the sun is clear at sunset, that indicates calm, bright weather. A 3-day moon that is clear and thin also indicates clear weather. If the moon is thin but also seems fiery, this indicates strong wind, and then, when both the moon's horns are even and the northern horn is clear, that indicates easing westerly winds. In the event of a full moon darkening, expect rain, and in the event of the moon tapering from both sides, expect wind. But if there is a ring around the moon, this is a sign of foul weather, and if the ring darkens, that is very foul weather. Since this obviously interests the boy, why not tell him about it? Christopher asked himself. One time they came to the shores of the lake, and Christopher said, "The Lord ordered the waters to produce fishes to swim in its depths, and birds to soar in the heavenly firmament. All of them were created to navigate their appropriate elements. The Lord also ordered the earth to produce a live soul for four-legged animals. Animals were docile toward Adam and Eve until the fall. One could say they loved people. But now, that is only in rare cases. Somehow, everything went wrong." Christopher ruffled the scruff of the wolf who was trotting behind them. "And when it comes right down to it, the birds, fishes, and animals are similar to people in many ways. That, you see, is where our overall connection is. We teach each other. The lion cub, Arsini, is always born to the lioness dead, but the male lion comes and breathes life into it on the 3rd day. This reminds us that human children come to life only at christening. If death occurs before that day, it lasts for all eternity. There is no heaven. And then there is the fish with many legs. No matter what color stone it swims up to, it takes on that color. If it is white, it turns white. If it is green, it turns green. Some people, child, are the same. They are Christians with Christians and infidels with infidels. There is also the phoenix bird who has neither mate nor children. It eats nothing but flies among the Lebanese cedars, filling its wings with their aroma. When it grows old, it flies up into the sky and ignites from heavenly fire. When it descends, it sets fire to its nest and burns up itself, reappearing later in the ashes of its nest as a worm, from which a phoenix bird develops over time. And thus, O Arsini, those who take on suffering for Christ are reborn in all their glory for the kingdom of heaven. Finally, there is the Caladrius bird, which is completely white. If one falls into illness, he can learn from the Caladrius if he will live or die. And if he will die, the Caladrius will turn his face away, but if he will live, the Caladrius will merrily fly up into the air against the sun, and everyone will understand the Caladrius took the sick person's sore and scattered it in the air. And that is how our Lord Jesus Christ ascended the tree of the cross and imparted to us his purest blood to heal sin. So where can we get that bird? The boy asked. You shall be that bird yourself, O Arsini. After all, you can fly a little. The boy nodded pensively, and his seriousness made Christopher feel ill at ease. The last leaves were blowing from the shore onto the lake's black waters. The leaves tumbled in disarray along the brownish grass, then quivered on the lake's ripples, and sailed further and further off. Fishermen's deep boot tracks were visible at the very edge of the water. The tracks were filled with water and looked age-old, left behind forever and ever. Leaves floated in them, too. A fishing boat swayed not far from the shore. The fishermen pulled a net with hands reddened from cold. Their foreheads and beards were wet with sweat. The sleeves of their clothing were heavy with water. A medium-sized fish thrashed in the net. Glistening in the dim autumn sun, the fish whipped up a froth around the boat. The fishermen were satisfied with their catch and loudly shouted something to each other. Orsini could not make out their words. He could not have repeated a single word the fishermen said, though he heard them distinctly. Unhurried, the words turned into sounds and dissolved into the expanse, after shedding the shells of their meaning. The sky was colorless because it had given all its hues to summer. There was a smell of wood smoke. Arsini felt joy because they would also build a fire in the stove and enjoy a special autumn coziness when they came home. Like everyone else around them, they lit black fires. Once the fire got going, the house's walls warmed, their thick logs holding the warmth for a long time. A clay stove held it even longer. The stones placed at the stove's far wall got red hot. Smoke rose under the high ceiling and pensively went out through an open vent over the door. The smoke seemed like a living being to Arsini. Its leisureliness calmed him. The smoke lived in the upper part of the log house, which was black from soot. The lower part was tidy and bright. The upper and lower parts of the log house's walls were divided by polovochniks, wide boards onto which the soot sprinkled. If a fire was properly stoked, the smoke did not sink below the polovochniks. It was Arsini's responsibility to build fires in the stove. He brought in birch logs from the woodshed and laid them in the stove like a little house. He pushed sticks of kindling between the logs. He got the fire going with smoldering coals taken from the ochloks, special niches within the stove where layers of ash preserved coals to use for lighting. He buried the coals in dry leaves and blew with all his might. The leaves would slowly change color. Burning now from their underside, they still appeared to be shrinking indifferently, but that grew more complicated for them with each instant. The fire seized them abruptly from all sides at once. The fire spread from the leaves to the kindling wood, and from the kindling wood to the logs. The sides of the logs began to burn. If they were damp, they crackled, shooting out sheaves of sparks. The child saw a phoenix bird in the fiery blizzard and pointed it out to the wolf sitting next to him. The wolf squinted every now and then, but it was unclear if he actually saw the bird or not. Arsini looked doubtfully at the wolf and announced to Christopher, "He's sitting unnaturally. I would even say tensely. I think he simply fears for his skin." The boy was right. The sheaves of sparks that flew out of the stove brought a distinct disquiet to the wolf. Only when the fire had settled into an even, complete burning did the wolf sprawl out on the floor and lay his head on his paws like a dog. "For what you have tamed, you become responsible forever," Christopher said, stroking the wolf. At times, Arsini saw his own face when he looked inside the stove. It was framed by gray hair that was gathered on the back of his neck. His face was covered with wrinkles. Despite the dissimilarity, the boy understood it was a reflection of himself, only many years later, and under different circumstances. It was the reflection of someone who is sitting by a fire and sees the face of a light-haired boy and does not want the person who has entered to disturb him. The person entering the room shifts from foot to foot at the threshold and, placing a finger to his lips, whispers to someone over his shoulder that the doctor of Al-Rus is busy now. He is observing the flame.
"Let her in, Melody," says the old man, not turning. "What do you want, O woman?"
"I want to live, O doctor. Help me."
"And you do not want to die?"
"There are those who want to die," explains Melody. "I have a son. Take pity on him."
"Is he like that one?"
The old man points at the mouth of the stove, where the image of a boy is discernible in the contours of the flame.
"There is no reason for you to kneel, my lady."
Melody is agitated and gnawing his nails. He does not like that. The old man tears his gaze away from the flame. He approaches the kneeling princess and sinks to his knees alongside her. Melody walks out backwards. The old man takes the princess by the chin and looks into her eyes. He wipes her tears with the back of his hand.
"You, O woman, have a tumor in your head. That is why your vision is worsening, and your hearing is dulling."
He embraces her head and presses it to his chest. The princess hears the beating of his heart, the labored, elderly breathing. Through his shirt, she feels the coolness of the cross he wears around his neck, the rigidity of his ribs. She herself is surprised she notices all this. Behind the closed doors, Melody is cutting splinters from logs so they may be burned as lamps. There is no expression on his face.
"Believe in the Lord and his most blessed mother and ask their help."
The old man's dry lips touch her forehead.
"And your tumor will shrink. Go in peace and grieve no more."
"Why do you weep, O Arsini?"
"I weep from joy."
Arsini wordlessly turns to the wolf. The wolf licks away his tears. 6. Man was created from dust and will return to dust, but the body that is given to him for the duration of his life is splendid. You must know the body as well as possible, O Arsini. That is what Christopher said as he embalmed Andron Novgorodets before sending the deceased off to his homeland. Christopher was rubbing cedar resin mixed with honey and salt into Andron's skin at one of the bathhouses in Rukina Quarter. Andron's whole body shuddered every now and then from Christopher's touch and seemed alive. Reinforcing that impression was the deceased's large member, which did not seem to correspond to Andron, who was short of height, though firmly built. Arsini thought Andron would stand up at any minute, thank Christopher for his troubles, and go outside for fresh air. But Andron did not stand. After a nighttime fight, he lay with a fractured skull and the first corpse spots on his back. The out-of-towner Andron had taken an interest in the girls of Rukina Quarter. That was just yesterday. That caused the fight. Today, Andron was preparing for his final journey to Novgorod. God's boundless wisdom is reflected in the small human body, said Christopher, like the sun in a drop of water. Each organ is thought out down to the smallest detail. The heart, for example, nourishes the whole body with blood, and they say our feelings are concentrated in the heart, which is why it is securely protected by the ribs. The teeth are of hard bone because they chew. The tongue recognizes taste, and that is why it is as soft and porous as a sponge. And the ear was created in the form of a shell to catch flying sounds. And protruding ears, by the way. Christopher ran a finger along Andron's ear. are a sign of empty talk. But there is also an inner ear that is not visible. It leads sounds from the outer ear to the brain, and the brain turns the sounds into speech. Vessels from the eye go to the brain too, and so the brain also turns letters into words. The brain is the body's tsar, and it is at the very top because, of all earthly beasts, only man is a rational being and walks upright. His incorporeal thinking, located within the body, ascends to the heavens and comprehends the perfection of this world. The mind is the soul's eyes. When those eyes are damaged, the soul becomes blind. What is a soul? Arsini asked. It is what the Lord breathes into a body, what distinguishes us from rocks and plants. The soul makes us living beings, O Arsini. I compare the soul to a flame that originates in an earthly candle but has no earthly nature as it strives skyward toward its kindred elements. If a soul makes something alive, does that mean animals have them? Arsini pointed at the wolf who stood alongside them. Yes, animals have souls, but the soul is kindred to their bodies and contained within their blood. And, mind you, people did not eat animals until the flood. They spared their souls, for an animal's soul dies with its body. A human's soul, though, is of a completely different nature from the body and does not die with the body. For the human soul cometh from nothing else but the Creator himself and was inspirited by his grace. What fate is judged for human bodies? Our body disintegrates into dust, but the Lord who created the body from the dust can make our disintegrated body come together. And, as you know, it only seems to us that the body decomposes without a trace, that it mixes with other elements, becoming soil, a river, grass. Our body, O Arsini, is like quicksilver that lies broken into tiny beads on the earth, but does not mix with the earth. It lies there by its lonesome until some skilled craftsman comes and collects it all, putting it back into a vessel, and that is how the Almighty will collect our decomposed bodies again for the universal resurrection. Thanks to Christopher's labors, the decomposition of Andron's body was halting. The body had a dull gleam and gave off the scent of cedar. It was improbably white. The exceptions were the face and the arms up to the elbows, which preserved traces of a recent tan. After he finished rubbing in the embalming ointment, Christopher began winding Andron in linen strips. He ripped them with a loud tear from a piece of fabric he had been brought with him, moistening them in the ointment and tightly pressing them to the body of the deceased. Andron did not resist. His eyelids, loosely closed, lent him a sarcastic and even somewhat reckless look. It seemed Andron was chuckling at the perspiring Christopher's efforts. It was as if he was letting it be known with all his person that he would certainly make it to Novgorod under any circumstances. Christopher did not look at Andron's face. He wrapped his body, strip by strip, tightly knotting the ends. Since the conversation had already turned to the body, Christopher said, "I'll tell you how children are conceived. After all, you are no longer a child anymore, and it is time for you to know that ever since the time of the fall of Adam and Eve, people are no longer created by the Lord, but give birth to their children themselves. Later they die because they acquired the gift of death along with the gift of birth. A child is conceived from male seed and female blood. Male seed gives the firmness of bones and sinews, and it is female blood that gives flesh its softness. Blood, as you know, is red and flows through the blood vessels, but male seed is located here," Christopher points out Andron's large balls as he wraps them up against Andron's thigh, "and it is white." Arsini did not tell Christopher he knew the color of seed. He had spoken about this to Elder Nicander in confession. "Keep your hands above the bedspread," Elder Nicander had advised. "This was not at home, but at the cemetery," Arsini said. "Well, now,
That is quite something, Elder Nicander said with a whistle. At the cemetery and everything. It is live people who lie there, after all.
I saw only the dead.
For God, all are living.
Arsini turned away.
But I have begun to fear death.
The elder ran his hand along Arsini's hair. He said,
Each of us repeats Adam's journey and acknowledges with the loss of innocence that he is mortal. Weep and pray, O Arsini. And do not fear death, for death is not just the bitterness of parting. It is also the joy of liberation.
7. Arsini learned to read at an early age. Within a few days he had learned the letters Christopher had showed him and could soon combine them into words without difficulty. At first it bothered him that the words in most books were not separated from one another, but rather flowed in a continuous series. One day Arsini asked why the words were not written separately.
"But are they really pronounced separately?" said Christopher, answering the question with a question. "I will also tell you this. At times it is not crucial how a word is spoken and by whom. All that is important is that it has been spoken, or, at the very least, thought."
Christopher's notes written on birch bark became Arsini's first and much-loved reading. There were several reasons for this. The birch bark manuscripts were written in large, distinct penmanship. They were not large in size. They were Arsini's most accessible reading because they were lying all around the house. Finally, Arsini saw how they were made. Christopher worked on preparing birch bark in spring, during the time a tree's sap is in motion. He peeled it from the trunks in neat, wide bands that he then boiled in brine for several hours. The bark grew soft and lost its brittleness. Christopher cut the bark into even sheets after processing it. It was now ready for use, a perfect substitute for expensive paper. Christopher did not dedicate any particular time to writing. He could write in the morning, afternoon, and evening. Sometimes, if an important thought came into his head during the night, he would get up and write it down. Christopher wrote down what he had read in books. And King Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines and 8,000 books. He wrote down his own observations. On the 10th day of the month of September, Arsini's tooth hadst fallen out. He wrote down his doctorly prayers, contents of medicines, descriptions of herbs, information about natural anomalies, weather omens, and brief edifying statements. Guard thyself from the silence of a loathsome man, as if he were a loathsome dog who doth steal in secret. He used a bone stylus to scratch out letters on the inside of the birch bark. Christopher did not write because he feared forgetting something. He never forgot anything, even when he reached old age. For Christopher, the written word seemed to regulate the world, stop its fluctuations, prevent notions from eroding. This is why Christopher's sphere of interest was so broad. According to the writer's thinking, that sphere should correspond to the world's breadth. Christopher usually left his writings in the places where he had made them, on the bench, on the stove, on the woodpile. He did not pick them up when they fell to the floor. He vaguely anticipated their discovery much later in a cultural stratum. Christopher understood that the written word would always remain that way. No matter what happened later, once it had been written, the word had already occurred. By watching and following Christopher's movements, Arsini already knew where to search for his notes. Sometimes the place where one manuscript turned up would be the location for another one, or even more that very same day. At times, Arsini's grandfather seemed like a hen carrying golden eggs that needed only to be gathered in good time. The boy even learned to guess the nature of what was written based on Christopher's facial expression. Knitted brows led him to surmise the current manuscript denounced heretics. An expression of quiet joy accompanied predominantly edifying statements. According to Arsini's observations, Christopher pensively scratched his nose when specifying heights, volumes, and distances. The child read the birch bark manuscripts out loud. Basically, during the Middle Ages, people read predominantly out loud, at the very least, simply moving their lips. Arsini piled the notes he particularly liked in a special basket. "If someone choketh on a bone, appeal for help from the Saint Vlasi." Vasily the Great, saith Adam, was in paradise 40 days. "Have not a friendship with a woman, and do not burn in fire." The variety of information staggered the child's imagination. But the scope of Arsini's reading was not limited to birch bark manuscripts. The Alexander Romance, the ancient story of Alexander the Great, lay under one of the icons in the holy corner. This book had been copied at one time by Feodosi, Christopher's grandfather. "It is I, Feodosi, a sinner who made a copy of this book in memory of brave people, that their deeds not go unremembered." That is how Feodosi addressed his descendants on the first page. He found in Arsini his most grateful reader. Arsini carefully moved the icon aside and took the book from the holder with both hands. He blew the dust from the binding and ran his hand along its darkened leather. There was no dust on the binding, but Arsini had seen Christopher act in this manner. Then the boy began on the clasps, unlatching them with a quiet brass sound. "It is I, Feodosi." Under that note was a portrait of Alexander made by his great-great-grandfather. Its hero sat in an uncomfortable pose with a royal crown on his head. Arsini read the Alexander Romance constantly. He read it sitting on the bench and lying on the stove, squeezing his arms between his knees and his head resting on his palms, in the mornings and in the evenings. Sometimes at night by the light of a burning splinter lamp. Christopher did not object. He liked that the boy read a lot. The wolf would approach Arsini at the first words of the Alexander Romance. He settled at the boy's feet and listened to the unusual narration. He carefully followed the events in the life of the Macedonian king, right along with Arsini. And so it emerged that Alexander discovered savage people when he arrived in the east. Their height was 2 sazhens, and their heads, Arsini's hand was on the wolf's head, were shaggy. After 6 days in the middle of the desert, Alexander's troops encountered astonishing people with 6 arms and 6 legs each. Alexander killed many of them and took many alive. He wanted to bring them to the inhabited world, but nobody knew what these people ate, so they all died. The ants in that same land were of such size that one of them dragged a horse off into its lair after capturing it. And then Alexander ordered straw be brought to the lair and set a fire, and the ants burned to death. Later on, after walking another 6 days, Alexander saw a mountain to which a man was bound with iron chains. That man was 1,000 sazhens in height and 200 sazhens in width. Alexander was surprised when he saw him, but dared not approach. And that man wept, and they heard his voice for another 4 days. From there, Alexander arrived in a forested area and saw other strange people. They were people above the waist, but horses below the waist. When he attempted to bring them to the inhabited world, a cold wind blew upon them, and they all died. And Alexander walked from that place for 100 days, feeling desolation when he neared the boundaries of the universe. Arsini closed the book, which he had been reading at the cemetery in the rays of the setting sun. It was not yet cold. Stones that had warmed during the day radiated heat. When the boy stretched out on a gravestone, he felt the warmth with his entire body. The stone bore no name. "Why are there no names on the graves?" Arsini once asked. "Because they are already known to the Lord," responded Christopher, "and their descendants have no need of the names. In 100 years, nobody will remember who they belong to. Sometimes that even happens after 50, or maybe even after 30. "Do people remember like that in the whole world, or only in Rukina Quarter?" "The whole world, I suppose, but especially in Rukina Quarter. We do not build marble crypts, and we do not carve out names, for our cemeteries are granted the right to turn into forests and fields, which is gratifying." "Does that mean our people have a short memory?" "One might say that. It is just that memory should not be too long. That, you know, is not for the best. After all, some things should be forgotten. As it happens, I remember, Christopher indicated a gray stone, that Yeliezer Windblower lies here. He was a prosperous person and could afford a stone like this. But I would have remembered him without the stone. This person had a slight limp and spoke with a sharp, guttural voice. He spoke in spurts, going silent from time to time, so his speech limped too. He suffered from excess gases. He farted loudly, and I gave him a chamomile infusion. I gave him dill water and other anti-flatulence treatments, and forbade him to drink freshly drawn milk before bed. But since he had a cow, Yeliezer loved milk beyond measure, and drank his fill in the evening hours, which led to winds in the belly. Yeliezer also loved carving wood, and nobody in Rukina Quarter carved better than he, especially where window frames were concerned. He sniffled when he worked. He would keep saying something in low tones as if to himself. He ran his palm along his lips as if he were stopping his speech, as if he were afraid of what had been said. When it came right down to it, though, there was nothing dangerous in what he said. So he would hold forth about the qualities of wood, about what all of us in the quarter already knew, that oak is hard and pine is soft. And can you believe it, O Arsini? His window frames are still up. But people no longer remember Yeliezer. One might ask a young person, who is this Yeliezer, and he would not answer. And even the old men only vaguely remember him, because they remember indifferently, without love. But the Lord remembers with love and does not let any small detail slip his memory. Thus he does not need his name. Arsini is lying on the warm stone. He is lying with his belly down, the closed Alexander romance alongside him. The heads of yellow buttercups touch his face. It is ticklish, and he smiles. The wolf wags his tail the slightest bit.
Yeliezer, fart, the boy quietly requests. Even if it is just once, let that be your signal from there.
Offended, Yeliezer remains silent.